I'm speaking with Gene Sharp, who is senior scholar at the Albert Einstein Institution, an organization devoted to nonviolent action that he founded in 1983. For more than four decades, Gene Sharp has been working on the theory and practice of nonviolent struggle. His work has influenced the shaping of post-Soviet governments in Ukraine, Georgia, and the Baltics. He's widely acclaimed as the intellectual godfather of the recent revolution in the Middle East, and his books include Gandhi as a Political Strategist, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, Civilian Defense, and his definitive book, Waging Nonviolent Struggle, 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing today, Gene Sharp. What just recently happened in Egypt, of course, has caught the U.S. government by surprise and much of the world by surprise, and it's obviously created enormous amount of anxiety within these Middle Eastern governments, which are often potentates, run by potentates, theocrats or military dictators. But what's your sense of how this can be sustained? I mean, obviously, this is a middle-class revolution, as is the one that was suppressed in Iran and is re-emerging today on the streets of Tehran and other cities. How do these young people that you have inspired reach out to the broader majority of the country, given that you have a kind of conservative, ill-educated majority in Egypt and in Iran who are likely to support a theocracy, just as in many of the red states here in the United States, people support theocracy?
Well, I might challenge what you said about this being a middle-class movement. The CNN reports I have seen emphasize this as a cross-class phenomenon, with people from both very poor and also the middle class and also the more wealthy. In any case, I don't know Egyptian society or the society in these other countries very well, and so I wouldn't presume to tell them how they should move and what they should do in order to do whatever their plans are. That's entirely up to them.
Well, what you have pointed out, though, in the work that you've done, I think is really worth understanding, I think, and it's fundamentally inspiring, and that is that the history of nonviolent action is widely misunderstood and not appreciated, but people have won higher wages, broken social barriers, changed government policies, frustrated invaders, paralyzed an empire, and dissolved dictatorships. Given the historical record, it's sort of surprising that we're surprised.
That's accurate. But you just, once this knowledge gets out as to what nonviolent struggle is and how it's conducted, if it's going to be conducted skillfully, people are very eager to learn because they often feel that they are powerless and helpless, and they're also often very frightened of the problems of disobedience and what would happen if they disobey. And this has happened in Egypt. People were at the earlier stages of what happened there were amazed that everybody had lost their fear. And this was something that Gandhi had emphasized was essential for a powerful struggle, to cast off the fear and do what needs to be done, but don't worry about what's going to happen to you because you have a job to do. This oppression must be ended. And it appears that the Egyptians have learned that lesson very well. And they can also conduct their struggle very skillfully in terms of they're retaining a nonviolent discipline. They were using the slogans peaceful, peaceful, peaceful every time there was something a bit dangerous seemed to be happening around them, and they would say peaceful. Now you can do that at times with over 1 million people, and some people said 2 million people in a single movement. I find quite amazing. I have nothing to teach them on that score.
Well, I suppose the fundamental thing, Dr. Gene Sharp, that you have to teach all of us, and you've certainly taught people around the world in the Middle East, in Serbia with Otpor, in the various revolutions in the former Soviet bloc. I believe your work is translated into Burmese and Karen and other countries where you have a suppressed majority chafing under brutal rules. But I suppose the lesson that we all should understand is that rulers derive their power from those whom they rule. In other words, we give up our power to our leaders and we don't retain it for ourselves and our community and our friends.
That's right. That was the way that Gandhi often phrased it. But when I was doing my study of nonviolent struggle, I came across a problem in examining how this works, and I concluded that I didn't understand much about power, so I was fortunate to be accepted at Oxford University in England and studied this major political theorist as to where does power come from. And they identified their sources of power, which include, for example, legitimacy. And of course, in Egypt, the Mubarak regime had lost legitimacy very, very widely. It includes the human assistants, the people who obey and support and carry out the orders, the people who run the economic system and communications, the people who operate the bureaucracy and the civil service, the people who operate the police and the army to carry out orders. Because sometimes it's happened in revolutions that the people stop giving that help. They stop regarding the regime as legitimate. If it is not legitimate, it can be easily disobeyed, not without cost, because the dictators do not like people to disobey them, and they will brutally kill them, at times torture them, and whatever they can manage to do to try to reinstill that fear. But if the fear is gone, as people said repeatedly in the reports of the Egyptian struggle, then that is the beginning of the end of the dictatorship. It's just a matter of time if people can hold out.
But of course, what you pointed out, Dr. Gene Sharp, is that people and history does concentrate on the strengths and power of the despots, like the Gestapo, and the power of the military might, but they don't focus on these regimes' weaknesses.
Absolutely. The dictators tell you how powerful they are, for good reason. They want people to be intimidated and think that they are helpless in face of all of that. The reality is quite different, so that even the Nazis and the Gestapo were at times confounded by postcards that were sent in by protesters, for example, caused great dismay. Or the fact that women who knew their Jewish husbands had been arrested, would assemble on a square near the Gestapo headquarters in Berlin and demand their husbands released. And they were released and brought back from the concentration camps where they were headed to the gas chambers. People have immense power if they learn to use it. And that lesson that happened in Tunisia and elsewhere, that they were able to do this, this is possible, that is what it becomes so enlightening and is so dangerous for future oppression.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Gene Sharp, who's a senior scholar at the Albert Einstein Institution, an organization devoted to nonviolent action that he founded in 1983. For more than four decades, Gene Sharp has been working on the theory and practice of nonviolent struggle, and his work has influenced and shaped the revolutions in the post-Soviet states. He's been widely acclaimed as the intellectual godfather of the most recent revolutions in the Middle East, and including what we've just witnessed in Egypt. And his major work is Waging Nonviolent Struggle, 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential. And, of course, what we're focusing on here in terms of Egypt is throughout this struggle on television was we were watching Tahrir Square and the idea that these nonviolent protesters were up against these violent thugs who were highly organized and highly disciplined, and the dictator had 30 years of practice. against people that appeared to be leaderless. And you're suggesting here that we've grown up with the myth that it requires a saint or a Gandhi to make these revolutions work. And you argue that the truth is you don't need leaders. In fact, leaders can become a problem because they can sell out the revolution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is what is so amazing to so many people. You don't expect that these people could possibly succeed. A few years ago, a newspaper vendor near my home told me, he said, there's something funny going on in the world. The people without guns are winning. This was contrary to all reality that he was familiar with. And this lesson that people without guns can win, and they were more likely to win without the guns if they use their brains and wise strategy and bravery skillfully, and then they can bring down the dictatorship. But you have to learn how to do that skillfully. It's not genetic.
And Dr. Sharp, what is your sense then of, since you've inspired so many of these revolutions, I started out asking the somewhat skeptical question about the future of the Egyptian revolution, given the possibility that the majority, once they get the vote, might vote for the Muslim Brotherhood over the people that brought about these tech-savvy young people, secular young people who brought about this revolution. And we saw what happened in Iran, and we saw when the people that you inspired in Iran rose up and the state media accused you of being the CIA mastermind about it, they've been crushed, but now they're coming back again. So what's your prognosis for this 21st century movement? I mean, I take it that your fundamental belief is that the future is with these young people, and the regimes that they're fighting are relics of the past.
Well, that's a little simple. And let's get one thing straight. To my knowledge, I've not inspired anybody. They got their inspirations from themselves and the situations they've lived through and what they have done. And merely inspiring people doesn't do anything anyhow if they don't know what to do. All I've done is to write what I've learned from the records of what people have done in the past and shared that perhaps in a new way with people. And they've gained some sense that they are capable, that they can do things. And that's very important. I'm not an authority on the Muslim Brotherhood, but it seems to me there's a lot of paranoia around. The Muslim Brotherhood is the only organization that I know of that put my essay From Dictatorship to Democracy on their website in Arabic years ago, advocating, it's explaining how nonviolent struggle worked, the same essay that was used in Serbia and many other countries in their struggles, such as in the Ukraine, for example. So I think people should learn how to do that. And people, if you get see people are going to have the vote, you have to make sure your candidates are better, have a better message than other candidates. And that's fine, because that's what you're supposedly struggling to achieve, to get a really democratic, people-powered system.
Well, I suppose the point I'm trying to make, and obviously I'm meandering a bit here, Dr. Sharp, is that the government in Iran that's suppressing the young green movement that's cracked their heads and forced them underground, and they've reemerged over the last few days and will continue over the next few days, they get their support from the vast sort of uneducated masses, if you will. And I'm just trying to figure out how you get from the young people who understand what's going on to the broader masses. And then, in other words, stage two of the revolution.
You have to be aware that if you're bringing down one government, you temporarily have a major shift in power, and then other people will want to manipulate that, whether it's a foreign intelligence agency or whether it's an internal group who will want to seize control of the state apparatus and use it for their own purposes. Therefore, that is what happened in Russia and the so-called October Revolution, after the February Revolution was nonviolent and virtually leaderless, after that it brought down the czarist system, then there was a period of some months of confusion, and then finally the Bolsheviks concluded they could seize control of the government buildings, declare themselves the saviors of the revolution, and impose their own dictatorship, which led directly to Stalin. Now, people have to be aware that we're the only ones, the Albert Einstein Institution, which I know of, has issued a booklet, on how to prevent coup d'etat, this seizure of a state, and how to resist if it is attempted. It's a very important booklet. It's now on our website and in several languages. And I wish to call people's attention to that. But don't think just by bringing down something, you've ushered in a political salvation. It doesn't work that way.
When you say, in all modesty, Dr. Sharp, that you haven't inspired anybody, your work is certainly being disseminated, and the Albert Einstein Institution, operating on a shoestring, to my mind, is doing more than the U.S. State Department in terms of helping change the world for the better. And the fact that the Iranian regime on state television, through its propaganda, is singling you out as the CIA mastermind behind the Green Movement would indicate to me that you are inspiring people. If you're getting blamed, you're doing something right.
Well, I'm not sure I would call that inspiration. That is shedding the picture of reality. That this kind of sorrow can be done, it can be operated skillfully, and if you use your heads and plan carefully, and are courageous and persistent and keep it nonviolent, you have a decent chance of winning.
Well, let's talk about your seminal work at Waging Nonviolent Struggle, 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential. What do you mean by 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential?
In that book, we have summaries of about 20-some cases of the use of nonviolent struggle in the 20th century, starting with a fairly long account I did of the Russian 1905 revolution, which almost succeeded, except that the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks both succeeded in turning a predominantly nonviolent revolution in 1905 into violence. When it was turned to violence and the soldiers were being shot at, of course the soldiers shot back and therefore resumed obedience to the Tsar at the point that they were on the verge of mutiny and making the Tsar system collapse. That's the brilliance in sarcasm of the advocacy of violence. And that goes way on up. But then now we, and I'm not alone at this, that we have learned quite a bit about how nonviolent struggle works. It does not work as the pacifists sometimes claim, by melting the heart of the opponents. It comes by changing the power relationships in the society, by the people taking back their prerogatives of controlling their lives themselves and disobeying orders from their dictatorships. And then for beyond the 20th century into the 21st century, how can this be used in the future, as it's all been demonstrated in Tunisia and Egypt, for example, the bringing down autocratic systems? Could it be used to block coup d'etat in countries which are some of the victims of coup d'etat, as happens in Thailand? When this was, in fact, put into the constitution of Thailand at one point to block military coups, the military carried a successful coup again, and they changed the constitution so people wouldn't have that right. So this can be done. How can this be developed now that we know what to do broadly? Now how can we learn how to do this skillfully and particularly so that people can actually use their potential, harness their potential in wielding effective power to change the system?
Again, I'm speaking with Gene Sharp, who is a senior scholar at the Albert Einstein Institution, an organization devoted to nonviolent action that he founded in 1983. For more than four decades, Gene Sharp has worked on the theory and practice of nonviolent struggle, and his work has influenced the shaping of post-Soviet governments through the Velvet Revolutions and others, and Otpor in Serbia. And his most recently, of course, he's been named as the intellectual godfather of these recent revolutions in Tunisia and in Egypt, and his seminal book, Waging Nonviolent Struggle, 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential, we are talking about here today. Of course, you quote a wonderful quote from Tolstoy saying, in terms of how did 30,000 Englishmen subdue 200 million Indians, to which Tolstoy responded, it is not the English who have enslaved the Indians, but the Indians who have enslaved themselves. And that gets, of course, to the heart of your fundamental argument, Ryan.
That's correct. And I was amazed when I got to Oxford and read for some months all of these very important classical political theorists who were by no means radicals of any stripe, and to learn that these theorists said that the sources of power are where the dictators get their power. And you can identify those, as I mentioned, and then you can learn, once you know where they are, you can shrink them, you can cut them off, and you do that by reducing your obedience, reducing your cooperation. And then with no sources of power, the dictatorship shrinks its power and finally dissolves. This has happened in several cases.
Well, I think in a way, though, aren't you arguing here, Dr. Gene Sharp, that the power of these dictatorships are their ultimate vulnerability? Isn't that the paradox?
Their vulnerability, if people learn that that's the case. But most dictators don't like you to know that. That's one reason my punk dictator democracy has been denounced frequently, because it's a very dangerous document. And that's why people have been arrested for carrying it in translation. People have been jailed for carrying it in Burma, and people have been jailed for carrying it in Vietnam, for example. In Moscow, it was in translation. At a printing office in Moscow, when the FSB, the successor to the KGB, arrived and raided the place and said, "What is this document?" And they looked at it and saw what it was, and they said, "This book is a bomb." And the printing stopped. They took the manuscript elsewhere, got it printed, smuggled back into Moscow. So bookstores that were selling it in Moscow, two bookstores burned within a few weeks after that because of that. Dictators don't want this knowledge to escape. But once, it's like the genie in the bottle. If once the genie gets out of the bottle, you can't put it back again.
So I'm reminded, in a way, from what you're telling us here, Dr. Gene Sharp, I'm a little bit reminded of, first of all, of the famous scene in The Wizard of Oz when that curtain is pulled back, and that the extent to which when these dictators are exposed, they turn out to be such pathetic people in a way. I'm reminded of Bertolt Brecht's play about Hitler, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, that focuses on how insignificant he really was as a person. Yet history judges him as a great man. Do you share that kind of sense of paradox?
Yeah, I think you're right on that. That's very, very wise perception you have.
How do you get to that point, though, of pulling back the curtain and exposing the fatuous nature of these people?
To my knowledge, there hasn't been any research down on exactly that point, but there should be. It's needed very, very much.
You would think that with the technology we have today and the ubiquitous nature of communication, that it would be more difficult for dictators to maintain this facade of authority and dignity.
You would think so. And the events, sometimes we would learn vicariously. The Egyptians learned that by watching what happened in Tunisia, for example. About 1944, there were nonviolent uprisings against military dictators in both El Salvador and Guatemala. And in Guatemala, they learned what happened in the neighboring country of El Salvador. They demonstrated it happened and that they could do the same thing. But they did it skillfully, and therefore they were both temporarily liberated, but then they didn't use their liberation wisely, and they fell back into military control again. You have to use their victory wisely and block the ones who come in and say, now we're the liberators, but they really are the new dictators.
Is there any analogies here or any lessons in the work that you've done that, I won't use the word inspired, but that has informed all of these revolutions around the world that we've witnessed since the collapse of the Soviet Empire in 1989 and up to the present moment where we have just witnessed this extraordinary event in Egypt, and we are witnessing riots in Yemen, in Bahrain, and certainly in Tehran, repeats of what's been going on before with the Green Movement. There is, as you said earlier, that the genie is certainly out of the bottle. But in terms of the United States, I know it's not fair to make any kind of analogies that we have a fairly functioning democracy, but arguably our democracy has been captured by powerful monetary and corporate interests. Our economy has been captured by plutocrats. So, and we are becoming less educated. And it seems to me the lesson that I've at least learned from what's happened in these revolutions around the world is that they have been propelled by educated people.
That often happens, but not always. The educated people sometimes are not so masters of the as genius, but they can learn what can be done. And again, you don't have to have a super a PhD education if you're Egyptian and you get the news reports of what happens almost next door in Tunisia. If it's there, it's happened. There was a Kenneth Boulding, a Quaker economist, a prize economist and theorist. He said that there was something called Boulding's First Law. I think he stole the idea from the Greeks. And he said, that which is possible. That which can happen can be done again. And that was the lesson that he offered, that which I still think is so important. You can believe in something that's really happened. If the news escapes the prisons of censorship and spreads out to the people, and then they begin to test it in their own lives and in this local grievances and small scale actions, and finally realize this worked, we can do it again.
So in terms of the United States, are you concerned about the possibility of a Sarah Palin becoming president? And already the latest revolution we've had here has not been, it's been the opposite of the revolutions they've had in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East. We've had a Tea Party revolution that's ended up carrying the water for billionaires who have funded these so-called AstroTurf operations.
I would not use the term revolution for that. That's a protest movement. The revolution is a changing of the system, as we have seen a mass uprising from the whole population, as you have seen most recently in Egypt.
This is obviously not on the same scale, but is it a trend that bothers you? Or do you, I mean, as me, as somebody that I would wish for, you know, more political activism in this country that would restore our democracy, would restore social justice and economic fairness, what kind of organization should me and my listeners embrace? I mean,
well, again, I can't tell you, and I won't tell you. Mm-hmm. If I knew, I don't know exactly what to do, but I trust the American people to find ways to do what needs to be done to change the situation from what they are worried about. This is when people come to us and into our humble office, and they sometimes ask, well, what should we do? And I refuse to tell them. I can say there are these things you can study and from which you can learn, And then you have to know your own society and its problems and its weaknesses and its strengths. And you have to learn how to think strategically so that your actions can be effective, act skillfully, and then you have a chance. But those are the... You don't come to anybody and say, what should we do? You figure that out on your own with other people working together with existing organizations or new ones, and you can make that a success if you learn and study how to do it and do it skillfully.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. Gene Sharp, do you believe that the president, as our leader, and arguably he's in charge of our foreign policy, although there's clearly a certain inertia in the State Department, the Pentagon, and the intelligence services in terms of our long foreign policy practice of realpolitik, where we act in our so-called interests, but not according to our ideals. It seems that since Egypt, we have reached a turning point where perhaps in the future, acting according to our ideals will be more in our national interest.
I would hope so. But you see, people in high positions often don't really understand what's going on. That's been clearly the case in concerning the struggles in Tunisia and in Egypt. But at a certain point, it becomes undeniable. That's why they find no explanations to dismiss that. In the olden days, they used to dismiss the Gandhian struggles against the British Empire, the most vast empire the world had ever known. And they said, oh, that was because the British were so gentlemanly. And they really were not gentlemanly. They were less cool than someone else might have been. But they were not gentlemanly. There was the massacre of men, women, and children, the massacre of Jallianwala and Amritsar. And it was because Gandhi had taken hold of the power of nonviolent struggle that you could get your objective more powerfully and more successfully if you did not use the guns, which were the tools of oppression. Don't use the tools of oppression that your oppressor uses, because then your oppressor will win. Use these nonviolent ways of people power that it has been demonstrating in case after case in the recent century as how to do this, and then you have a chance of winning.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, Gene Sharp. Again, I've been speaking with Gene Sharp, who's a senior scholar at the Albert Einstein Institution, an organization devoted to nonviolent action that he founded in 1983. And for more than four decades, Gene Sharp has been working on the theory and practice of nonviolent struggle. His work has influenced the post-Soviet revolutions, and he is widely acclaimed as the intellectual godfather of the recent revolutions in the Middle East. And his seminal book is Waging Nonviolent Struggle, 20th Century Practice and 21st Century Potential. Thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr. Gene Sharp.
Thank you, Ian, and good wishes to all your listeners.